Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today, Pennsylvania unveiled its new deal for Pennsylvania. Senate Democrats came out and said, look, we're gonna invest $6.15 billion that the federal funds that are coming into the state. We definitely, without question, need that kind of investment into our Commonwealth to help us move forward. We need investment for children. We need investment for business. There's a lot we need to be doing, and a lot that we need to be focusing on: education, job training, lots of stuff. Utility assistance. We've got a lot of work to do. And if you look around the Commonwealth, we seriously have stuff to do. And then you throw in the infrastructure. We've got a lot of infrastructure improvements that need to happen. We've got roads and bridges and all of those things that need to be functional, that we need to do to get done. We've got so much that needs to be done and so much that needs to be invested in that I'm actually looking forward to this in a big way. And that's why I've asked Pennsylvania State Senator Vince Hughes to come talk with us. Senator Hughes is the Democratic chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee, one of the guys in charge of making sure the Pennsylvania New Deal gets spent in the right way. Senator Hughes, thanks for taking time for us.
What's up, Rick? How you doing, man?
I am fantastic. I got to tell you, I'm looking at this and I'm going, long overdue, something I've been calling for decades now, and it's about time.
It's definitely about time. You know, somebody asked me earlier today, Rick, why a new deal? Why a new deal? And, you know, they might have been young, so that could be the reason, Rick, if you know what I mean. But I had to tell them, I said, look, the crisis that we're in, that has been revealed by the pandemic, everyone said it is almost a replica, almost an exact replica of the crisis that we were in back in the Great Depression. We ran through the numbers today. It is just alarming. Female unemployment rates twice what they were in March of 2020 before the pandemic hit. Black and Hispanic unemployment rates twice now what they were back right in that March right before the pandemic. But I think that the thing that was most revealing, Rick, and I know it hurt your heart, but when it was not the numbers, but it was the visual. I don't think I'll ever forget the long car lines of folks waiting for food. I think it was outside of Pittsburgh. I don't think I'll ever forget that, all right? And nor should I, or nor should we. We should never forget that. No one is supposed to be in that situation. And folks here in Pennsylvania, in the United States, should definitely not be in that situation. This being the richest, you know, the wealthiest country in the world, should never be in a situation like that. But we were.
Right.
And so we had to come up with a program that meets the reality of the moment that we're in. And this program, a New Deal for Pennsylvania, meets that reality. This is no tax increases, nothing like that, all right? This takes American Rescue Plan money. And I say it in a press conference today, I think you'll appreciate it. Thank you, Joe Biden. Thank you, Vice President Harris. Thank you, Speaker Pelosi. Thank you, Majority Leader Schumer, for driving the American Rescue Plan home, getting it to us, and then putting us in a position to make a Pennsylvania-based program dealing with the realities that exist in Pennsylvania. It is robust, it is bold, it is aggressive, but you know what, Rick? That's what our people need. They needed it before the pandemic. They definitely needed it before the pandemic. And the pandemic revealed how much hell our people are going through. Nope. That's why we came up with this idea today.
No, and it's a good one. And I noticed you didn't thank Senator Toomey or any of the Republicans in the Senate, because not one of them voted for this plan to help the people that need it.
Well, that's why I was very specific with those who I announced. And the thing about it, Rick, is folks, everyone in Pennsylvania is going to benefit from the American Rescue Plan. Everyone, Democrats, Republicans, Green Party, Independents, no matter who you are, in every corner of the state, in every nook and cranny of the Commonwealth, all right? They're going to benefit from the American Rescue Plan. And so even those who didn't vote are going to benefit from it. And it's interesting, and I know you've called them out on this in your previous programs. You got a lot of Republican senators and congressmen and women all around the country who are trying to take credit for the programs that they didn't even vote for.
Yep.
But that's a whole nother story. That's not what tonight is about, man.
No, and this is about making sure that we use the money that we're going to get from the federal government to make our state the best it can be, do some of the infrastructural improvements that we've needed for decades. And, you know, I've been talking about, you know, the more than 5,000 structurally deficient bridges and you know, somebody creating an app to every time you go over a bridge to send you a text saying, call mom, you might not make it to the other side. I'm sure you saw the bridge in you know, Arkansas, that has a giant crack in it. It's not a crack. It's a broken beam. That I-40 bridge could come down at some point because our infrastructure is that badly broken, and we need this kind of investment. But it goes beyond just our infrastructure. It goes into our human infrastructure, taking care of our children, getting job training for workers, those kind of things, which I think are just as important as our roads and bridges.
Oh, it is just as important. And we've seen what... Rick, we've seen through the last 15 months how valuable our healthcare workers have been. They have been saving lives in a very difficult environment. They're the ones, Rick, that go, you know, when they tell us to run away from the fire, they're the ones who run into the fire, okay? The healthcare fire that we've all been dealing with for the last 15 months. And what has been revealed to us is that we need more healthcare workers, okay? We need to invest more in the ones that we have and the ones that we need to bring into the field, all right? And we need to make sure that the conversation around healthcare is not just in the context of when we have a pandemic, but when we have the rest of our 24/7 reality that we're dealing with. And, you know, we've got an issue that we're confronting right now on the whole vaccine piece, where we're going to have to change up how we're dealing with getting the vaccine and getting doses into people's arms. We're really going to have to start sending folks going door to door in communities, you know, knocking on doors. Hi, you home? Hey, Miss Johnson. I'm Joe from down the street. I'm here with the nurse. Okay. Ready to give you that vaccine. And so, but those are jobs, right?
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
And we get them to show up at schools and have, you know, permission slips from parents to get them done. We should already be doing this stuff. So,
exactly.
Vince, I mean, we should be down this road already.
Exactly. So that's what's involved in the American Rescue Plan. What the American Rescue Plan has done for us is has given us and every state the opportunity to craft a program at the state level that meets the needs of the people in Pennsylvania.
Right.
So when we talk about investing in after school programs, and we talk about investing in after school education programs, and we talk about investing in reading programs and getting folks back to where they were, getting our children back to where they were academically prior to the pandemic, where they lost so much school time. So much school time was lost. You know, you pay people to do that work. You hire teachers, all right, or classroom aides or folks like that who can be there with our children to help do that, to get that work done. It's an investment in our children. It's investment in the people of Pennsylvania. It clearly is investment in the infrastructure conversation. One of the pieces that we're talking about in this proposal, Rick, is $800 million to deal with our broken and toxic schools, getting them fixed up. and getting them prepared, prepared to deal with this new reality where COVID, because of its nature and because of the variants, might be with us for a while. So we got to make sure that our schools are in quality condition, as well as our childcare centers also.
No, I'm right there with you. But here's the question. It's a great plan. I like the ideas. There's good stuff in it. We've got a lot of crazy people in the Senate. I don't have to tell you. We've got some lunatics in the Pennsylvania State Senate. What are the chances of something like this getting done with the lunacy that we've seen from the Mastrianos of the world and their ilk?
Well, here's the trick. They can't use the tax question because nobody's raising taxes, okay? This is money coming to the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And here's the other piece. It goes for every community in Pennsylvania, all right? It's just not targeted to Philly or Pittsburgh or Harrisburg or whatever. It is pervasive. Every community, every county in Pennsylvania gets help from the New Deal for PA. And so
Stopped them from being against something before.
I know, but Rick, you got to speak the truth, right? Yeah. And we have to get behind this notion. We have to get involved in the conversation and say, look, this is good for everybody. This is good for everybody. Get involved. Get engaged. Call your legislator. Call your representative. Call your senator. Call the governor and say, these are the things that we want. That's going to be a negotiation. But everything good in life is worth fighting for, brother.
No, absolutely. Now, here's the thing that gets me, because you brought up the New Deal, coming out of the Depression in the 1930s. We are reliving a lot of that. And I always like to tell the story of Smedley Butler and the coup attempt during the FDR years. Because our fascists at the time were trying to overthrow Roosevelt. We seem to have that kind of an undertone going on right now, as you've got people who, Donald Trump won the election. It was stolen, Vince. You stole the election, Vince. You and those Democrats got together, stole it from poor Donald Trump.
Poor Donald.
You got all these military officers now coming out basically saying, they're ready. They're ready to the clarion call. Send the codes, Donald. We're coming.
Donald Trump is going to meet his maker at some point. Justice is going to come to him at some point. I don't know where it's going to come from. But you know what? Justice was had on November 3rd last year. All right. Now, it took a couple weeks and months to count all the votes, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. But justice was had there. And we always got to recognize the win, Rick. We always got to recognize the win. Don't over-celebrate it, but we got to recognize the win so that our people understand that those things that we fight for, we can win on. We won on November 3rd, and we won by 7 million votes on November 3rd. Okay, so he met some justice there. Now he's been investigated by a whole bunch of folks, and his people are being investigated. They visited Rudy a week or so ago, his house and his office. All right, I'm sure there was some stuff they found there. So all of this is going to play itself out, and we have to make sure that we continue to speak the truth. What we can't do, Rick, is we can't get like them.
Right.
Okay. We can't get like them. All right.
No, what I've been saying, Vince, is very simple. We got to make people's lives better. We got a very short period of time. We've got to make people's lives better. Let the Republican Party eat themselves. Let them purge each other. Let them do whatever they're going to do. Don't have time for them. I've been saying about Liz Cheney. Don't care. Didn't care yesterday. Didn't care the day before. Don't care today. I care about getting the infrastructure bill moved through. I care about getting people's lives back on track, getting their families back moving in the right direction, and people having better lives. That's how people vote for Democrats, when you make their lives better. That simple.
That's it. That's it. But we have to tell the story, Rick. We've got to tell the story. Okay. We have to tell the story we voted in the election. We won the election. These things have happened since then, okay? And it's because of democratic principles, democratic values that have made your life better, that's why we've gone down this path. That's what this investment has been all about.
No, and it's good stuff. How do we help? How do we make sure that we get this through? Because look, there's like I said, there's a lot in here that I think is going to be really good. We definitely need job training. We definitely need, you know, some education support. We definitely need childcare, because, you know, you hear a lot of this, oh, we've got a labor shortage. No, we don't have a labor shortage. One, we have a poverty wage crisis. And two, we've got a childcare crisis, because the people who used to take those crummy hospitality jobs are women who have children who have nowhere to take them.
We have to fight for this. Now, let's be clear. And I want to say this again to you and your listening audience. In probably within the next 10 days, the actual transfer of American Rescue Plan dollars will show up in Pennsylvania's bank account. Okay? It will show up. This is no tax increase. This is the actual money will show up. So the money will sit there waiting for the legislature and the governor to make a decision on how it is to be spent. Side note, but important side note, Pennsylvania's budget is doing extremely well. All right. So there will not be a need to utilize a lot of these dollars to balance Pennsylvania's budget. There'll be need to use some of it, but not a significant amount of it, because Pennsylvania's budget is doing well. Right. Pennsylvania's people are not doing well. Pennsylvania's budget is doing well. So what I say all that to say this, to make sure your listeners understand this, we will have to figure out what to do with this money. We can't stash it for years and years and years to come. It's got to be spent. It is meant to be spent. And if it's not spent, it'll be taken from us.
Right. So,
and woe be the elected official who allows billions of dollars to be snatched away from the state and go to New Jersey or Montana or Texas or Georgia or some other place like that. Woe be the elected official who allows that to happen. So what I'm saying is that everybody's going to have a plan. What we wanted to do is lay out in a robust fashion what our proposal is to help shape the conversation and to get this thing home. It's important.
I'm with you.
People in Pennsylvania need it.
All right, good stuff. And I'll make sure we get links out so people can take a look at it at your website. I'm in favor of it. I'd love to have you come back and keep us informed of how this ball's rolling downhill.
You know I'm always here for you, Rick.
Thanks so much, Senator Vince Hughes. Appreciate the time. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day anti-union violence erupted in the Valley of Steel. The Little Steel Strike was then in its 20th day. The strike had spread to Bethlehem's Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Newspaper headlines screamed, 30 clubbed, stabbed, shot in strike. Guerrilla warfare breaks out anew in Pennsylvania. The day had been marred by hours of fighting with scabs and the police as miners joined picketers in support. Strikers lobbed rocks at scab cars attempting to drive through picket lines and successfully overturned a number of vehicles. Steel-helmeted police attacked strikers, swinging riot clubs and launching tear gas shells. One picketer, Tony Mandos, was in critical condition after having been shot twice by police. Mayor Daniel Shields announced he had deputized 250 special police and was preparing to, quote, raise an army of 3,000 American Legionnaires by nightfall to protect the city of Johnstown from strikers. At Warren, Ohio, dynamite crippled railroad operations at a struck Republic Steel Mill on the Ashtabula-Niles branch of the Pennsylvania Railroad. The explosion came after carloads of raw material had been shunted in and products shipped out of the mill. Auto plants throughout the Midwest slowed production for lack of steel-made parts. UAW President Homer Martin dispatched a telegram to CIO leader John L. Lewis saying, quote, "We are standing by ready to refuse to use steel made in struck plants in the production of automobiles, unless the steel companies make a speedy and amicable settlement with the striking steelworkers."
soldiers.
The CIO threatened a 20,000-strong strike support rally through the streets of Johnstown to protest the violence. They claimed victory when the governor quickly declared martial law and padlocked the gates of the Cambria Works.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So as I've been saying, this administration, the most pro-worker administration, at least of my lifetime, and I would feel safe to say the most pro-worker administration since FDR. Just throwing that out there. This has been an administration clearly on the side of working people, and I'm not surprised to see the U.S. Trade Representative Kathleen Tai and her office coming out and being very proactive and pushing this section of the USMCA, the formerly NAFTA, the new NAFTA, that was going to help Mexican workers organize and ensure that they get independent unions and have the right to collective bargaining and doing some of the things that I think we would like to have here too, but at least in a way ensuring that it happens in Mexico. And Mexico has a leader who's saying that they want that too. So this can be an interesting time. And here to share some thoughts on what exactly it is that the USMCA has done, what part of it we're talking about, and what these workers in Mexico endured, and maybe what the solution is going to be. I've asked Arthur Stamoulos to come talk with us. He's the executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Citizenstrade.org is their website. Arthur, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So let's walk through this from the beginning. You had the old NAFTA, which, you know, the only labor standards in it were very toothless and easy to get around. Trump renegotiated NAFTA, and there was some good stuff on the labor front, right?
Yeah, no, that's true. The Trump administration did renegotiate NAFTA. The deal that Trump initially signed off on had a couple of good things in it, but also a ton of junk, like, you know, new monopoly rights for pharmaceutical companies that would have jacked up medicine prices, language locking in deregulation for big tech. And so at that time, labor unions, consumer groups, Democrats in Congress, others, you know, looked at that initial deal and said, no way, like, this is not going to pass through Congress as written. And together we were able to force the removal of a lot of the bad language, particularly on medicines, but also were able to add new enforcement provisions that at least give us a shot at trying to enforce NAFTA's labor standards. And so, you know, that deal eventually passed. The Trump administration had the power to enforce labor standards within that revised NAFTA deal. They for whatever reason, never used those powers.
Right.
But now, less than 2 months after Joe Biden's new U.S. trade representative was confirmed, she already has a labor rights enforcement case going. It's one that labor unions didn't even ask her to do. She's done this on her own initiative. And so that alone is a sea change in attitude, right? Do you use trade agreements to try to help corporations get even richer, or do you use them to try to enforce labor rights? And so, you know, this new case and other cases are going to be a good test as to how well that NAFTA revision will or will not work moving forward. When Trump was in office, he didn't even try to make it work. But now we have people in power who are interested in seeing labor rights enforced. We're just going to have to see how far they can get with the tools in place.
Now, obviously, this story is about the 6,000 workers at the GM plant in Silao. Is that how it's pronounced? Silao?
Silao.
And evidently there was an election that went on, and there's a ton of the way it was explained to me, if I thought Amazon was bad, this was 10 times worse. And Amazon was really bad, that these workers, you know, clearly lost the election because of all of the things that went on. And now they're talking about a new election, right?
Yeah. So at issue in this case and in a lot of labor rights abuses cases across Mexico is this issue of what are called protection unions, where the company will work with a corrupt union. They'll sign a contract that the workers had no say in negotiating, no say in approving whatsoever. And this has been the case in Mexico for decade after decade after decade. And under Mexican labor law now, just in the past few years, that practice is supposed to be illegal, but it's still extremely widespread. And so this particular case involves a GM plant in central Mexico that produces hundreds of thousands of the Chevy Silverado and GMC Sierra pickup trucks, you know, a huge proportion of which are shipped, you know, shipped back to the U.S. And this plant has a protection union. Under the new law, the workers there are supposed to get to vote on their contracts. And so the company, you know, essentially tried to orchestrate a rubber stamp type election, you know, to approve that contract, but they got caught. You know, first off, the more than 6,000 workers at the plant had a 15-hour window to vote. They didn't even get to see, to read the contract. It wasn't even posted online. You know, it's like, oh, we've got a contract, vote on it. You don't get to see it. Then a bunch of the ballots that the workers, you know, put in opposing the contract got destroyed, and the protection union has refused to turn off the ballot, turn in the ballots that were counted over to authorities for account verification. And stuff like this is why, you know, Mexico has wages that are actually far lower than those in China, right? I mean, it's exactly why companies like GM like to set up shop there. Worker rights are not respected. And as a result, you know, workers are paid far, far less for the same exact work that workers in the US, you know, and other countries are paid for. And so the Biden administration has officially filed this complaint with the Mexican government. The Mexican government has 10 days to respond. And if some agreement isn't reached to rectify the issue, the US can eventually impose really heavy tariffs on the trucks coming to the US from that plant. It's about a 25% tariff. So when you look at the price of a truck, that's a lot of money. Yeah. And hopefully that's enough to get some justice for the workers at this plant.
Now, if I remember right, there was something talking about like all of the auto, especially in autos, that there was like a minimum wage that had to be paid of a certain, $16 pops into my head, but that seems really high for Mexican wages. Do you remember anything about that?
Yeah, so in the new NAFTA deal, there what's called rules of origin, which mean that the parts that go into a big product, like a truck, you know, like a car, that those parts have to be made by workers earning a, you know, earning a certain wage. And so when it comes to a car under the new NAFTA deal, you know, in total, all the parts have to be made by workers averaging $16 an hour, which, you know, I mean, it's a good precedent to set that there should be a wage standard in there. The problem is that, you know, it's probably a pretty easy standard to meet, you know, because they throw in stuff like the design of the product, you know, like the white collar folks wages who are getting, you know, six figure incomes averaging out with the, you know, these workers in Mexico who are making far, 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 far less. You know, so I'm skeptical that that's actually going to benefit any worker in Mexico, let alone in the United States. But, you know, it is an interesting precedent that we should be building off of moving forward.
I mean, it's something. I mean, at the end of the day, and this is where, you know, even when the former guy was in the White House, I said, look, the fact that he got some things into the USMCA that I don't think anyone else could have gotten, because I don't think Republicans would have ever gone along with getting rid of the tribunals and an actual some bit of labor law reform. I think, you know, I don't know that it's enough, but at least it was something.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for listeners to know that the Trump administration never proposed those labor reforms. Like, labor and Democrats in Congress are the ones who fought for it. But, you know, it certainly is true some Republicans went along with it who probably would not have were it not for a Republican in the White House. That's absolutely the case.
Yeah. So where do you see this going? Because there is some coordination going on, as I understand, from our U.S. trade rep and the person in Mexico that she deals with. What are we looking for? What do you think? What do you think this is going to bear out?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, because there is an administration in Mexico as well that is much more labor friendly than any previous Mexican administration for many decades. And one of the big problems they face is that the state governments in Mexico are often extremely hostile to labor, that, you know, they're part and parcel of this corrupt union protection union racket, and they don't want workers to have more power. And so the hope is that, you know, these NAFTA cases will you know, empower those elements in Mexico that are serious about independent unions and are serious about union rights, and also will be a way to pressure the corporations like GM that have always, you know, if not worked hand in hand with these corrupt protection unions, at least look the other way to make them understand, hey, you know, if you continue this, your products are going to face tariffs, and the benefit of moving to a low wage nation like Mexico are going to be taken away from you. So, you know, there's a lot of hope right now. The labor unions in the US and Mexico have filed another case under NAFTA for auto parts workers at a Trinex plant across the border, where, you know, workers who tried to form an independent union were illegally dismissed. Their attorney was arrested on trumped up charges. You know, another good example of how worker rights abuses in other countries, you know, in Mexico, not only hurt workers there, and certainly they hurt the workers there first and foremost, but also hurt workers in the U.S. because, you know, at that company, just a few years ago, 1,600 unionized workers in an auto parts plant owned by the same company here in Pennsylvania were laid off when the company decided to move production to Mexico. And so, you know, it just shows, you know, if we want to see good jobs, better wages anywhere, we can't allow this race to the bottom in worker rights to occur. You know, and so again, for the first time ever, we have a good U.S. trade representative willing to try to address these issues. You know, hopefully the tools that she currently has under the current NAFTA pact are going to be strong enough to allow for some of that change to happen. My guess is we're going to have to fight for even better deals and better laws moving forward.
And obviously our trade deals need to be updated with labor law reform happening. And look, this is a step in the right direction. Needs to be much stronger. We need to do much more. But, you know, the fact that we're talking about giving workers in Mexico the opportunity to raise their wages, I think is a good thing, because I think it will stem some of the flight out of the country. But there's still the behemoth in the room, and that's China. And it's still a lot of other places that we've got bad trade deals with. So it's my view that, you know, this is great. It's a step, but we got a lot more to go.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, this is a trade deal, you know, with Mexico and Canada. That's it. We're offshoring jobs all around the world, in particular to China. And so, you know, if our new trade ambassador, Catherine Tai, can show, you know, number one, where these existing labor standards can be used and how they can be used, and, you know, and maybe number two, where they fall short, hopefully we can get policymakers to push for even bigger changes, you know, on a bilateral basis and then eventually globally. You know, obviously we know that there are some policymakers who are with us on this, but it's going to be a fight to get workers' power. It always has been, it always will be.
Now, you know, I'm looking at this and, you know, you go really quick. We've got two cases. I can't imagine that it's going to end here. And I, you know, there potentially could be a flood of these to the point to where I think the system could completely bog down. And then we end up, you know, in the same kind of mess. No.
Well, I mean, hope, you know, it does take quite a bit of resources to file one of these cases. I mean, it's, I know that the unions who are involved in the filing that happened just this Monday, you know, spent many, many months, you know, sort of getting worker testimonials, preparing legal documents, et cetera, to make sure that they had a solid case that could be won, and that was the complaint that was filed. You know, you're absolutely right that, if these first initial tests of the system are successful, I mean, my hope is it will lead to a flood of additional cases, you know, and some actual change in the system for working people. But, you know, you're right. I mean, the situation in Mexico, you know, is not unique. This GM plant is not unique. The Trinex plant is not unique. This is what workers across the entire economy are facing. And, you know, and the hope is that these initial cases will start to make some change.
Right. So who hears this case? I mean, you said they built these cases. Who hears the cases?
Yeah. So the U.S., the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative in the White House is the first to sort of review the cases. And then if they decide there's enough here, they initiate the complaint with Mexico. Then Mexico has 10 days to respond, 45 days to you know, sort of come to some sort of plan. And if the two countries can't agree on an action plan to fix the situation, then it's heard by a panel of labor rights experts from both countries. You know, one country picks some of them, the other country picks some of the others, and they make a decision on the case ultimately. So and that's the point where if there's no agreement, you start imposing tariffs.
Okay, because, you know, I'm looking at that. I'm going, you know, again, this is one of those scenarios where it really depends on who's in the White House and who's choosing those people on that panel then, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, this is why, you know, the Trump administration signed off on it, but they never used the power. It's interesting because Joe Biden's U.S. Trade Representative is actually someone who was working for Democrats in Congress at the time and helped write many of these mechanisms. And so she knows them inside and out, and hopefully we'll be able to see them through to make actual change and get some workers some justice.
So since, I mean, this is your focus, how long is it going to be before we see the outcome in this? Because as you said, there's some pretty interesting deadlines going on. How soon before we see what the outcome of this is?
Yeah, so they call this a rapid response mechanism. I mean, it's going to take months before there's a final adjudication and final, agreement or imposition of tariffs. But if you look at some of our past trade agreements, the process actually took a decade.
Right.
So this is quite a bit faster. And the fact that, USTR has to respond to petitions within 30 days, and then if they move forward with them, Mexico has to respond within 10 days. That's quite a bit faster than what we've ever had in the past.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to see how this plays out, because this could be a great tool in helping to at least attempt to level the playing field. So I'm looking forward to it. But Arthur, I appreciate the time. It's always good talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
Good stuff. Arthur Stamulis, Executive Director of Citizens Trade Campaign, citizenstrade.org, the website. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day anti-union violence erupted in the Valley of Steel. The Little Steel Strike was then in its 20th day. The strike had spread to Bethlehem's Cambria Works in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Newspaper headlines screamed, 30 clubbed, stabbed, shot in strike. Guerrilla warfare breaks out anew in Pennsylvania. The day had been marred by hours of fighting with scabs and the police as miners joined picketers in support. Strikers lobbed rocks at scab cars attempting to drive through picket lines and successfully overturned a number of vehicles. Steel-helmeted police attacked strikers, swinging riot clubs and launching tear gas shells. One picketer, Tony Mandos, was in critical condition after having been shot twice by police. Mayor Daniel Shields announced he had deputized 250 special police and was preparing to, quote, raise an army of 3,000 American Legionnaires by nightfall to protect the city of Johnstown from strikers. At Warren, Ohio, dynamite crippled railroad operations at a struck Republic steel mill on the Ashtabula-Niles branch of the Pennsylvania Railroad. The explosion came after carloads of raw material had been shunted in and products shipped out of the mill. Auto plants throughout the Midwest slowed production for lack of steel-made parts. UAW President Homer Martin dispatched a telegram to CIO leader John L. Lewis saying, quote, "We We are standing by ready to refuse to use steel made in struck plants in the production of automobiles, unless the steel companies make a speedy and amicable settlement with the striking steelworkers. The CIO threatened a 20,000 strong strike support rally through the streets of Johnstown to protest the violence. They claimed victory when the governor quickly declared martial law and padlocked the gates of the Cambria Works.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you know how all we've been hearing the last week, at least the last week, is that employers can't find employees because they're lazy. And because Joe Biden has given them money and they're greedy. So lazy, greedy people don't want to go back to work for crummy wages. And understand, the places that are screaming the most are the ones who are in the fast food industry, in the hospitality industry, bars and restaurants. You know, the people who were paying crummy wages before the pandemic, you know, the ones who were paying poverty wages then. Well, the story now, headline blaring across over at Reuters, desperate for workers, U.S. restaurants and stores raise pay. And you go, about damn time. Good. It needed to happen. So the pandemic did anything? Maybe it boosted wages a little bit, and that's a good thing. Now, some other things I think the employers can be doing, helping us make sure that all of us get vaccinated. And here, share some thoughts on how employers can help do that. I've asked Emily G to come talk with us. She is a senior economist for health policy there at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org is their website. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me on, Rick.
So as a senior economist, you got to be looking at the pay raises going, yeah, this is how this works. You need workers. There's a shortage of workers. You sweeten the pot a little bit so that they come. It seems like common sense.
Exactly. That's how the market's supposed to work. One other thing that employers need to think about, too, is making sure that workers feel safe at work. We're only about a third vaccinated nationwide, and so employers can do a lot more to make sure that, that their communities get vaccinated, but their workers are safe too, especially when with today's news that vaccinated people no longer need to wear masks indoors.
Yep. No. And yesterday I talked a little bit about this story in Arizona where this golf cart company offered the employees who got vaccinated an extra dollar an hour in their paycheck. And the people who didn't get vaccinated, they were losing their minds because they felt like they were, well, we don't get it. Of course you don't get it because you're not protecting yourself. And then the question came up of, well, why would employers want their workers vaccinated outside of just the common sense of lower healthcare costs? Hey, we want our customers safe too. I'm curious your thoughts.
Sure. So protecting yourself is certainly part of it, right? We know that people who are vaccinated have a far lower rate of getting sick at all, a very small chance, compared to people who are unvaccinated of getting very sick. And the vaccine also prevents people from dying of COVID. But it's not just about ourselves. It's also about protecting our communities and protecting our coworkers at work, protecting our clients or customers if we're, in the workplace where we're face-to-face with other people, including people who might not be able to be vaccinated because they're kids or because they have, religious or, health reasons to not get vaccinated. So it's important for health, and it's also important for business. People will feel safer at work when the community is protected. And people will feel better about going out and being consumers too if they know that their chance of catching the coronavirus from the community is much lower.
Now, the thing that gets me is, I've had these conversations with, as someone who's, a member of a labor union and actually, does some work with labor unions, this question comes up of what if you have members who don't want to get vaccinated? How do you deal with that? What should the company, what responsibility does the company have? Can the company force them to do it? How do you see going forward this question playing out? Because look, we know there's going to be at least 25% of us who are stupid enough to go, no, we're never going to do it because, there could be Bill Gates, putting chips in our arms or aliens or whoever, whatever theory they come up with. You're going to get those recalcitrant people who are going to say this anyway. So you got to deal with them. How do employers deal with them, do you think?
So there are a variety of reasons why people don't get vaccinated or don't want to get vaccinated. And I think it's important for employers to consider why that is. So there are some people who respond to surveys saying that, they want to get it right away. I think that's, there are increasingly resources out there to get the vaccine at retail pharmacies, in community health centers. There are also, you know, people who are want to wait and see because they're concerned about the side effects. They're concerned about needing to miss work in order to just get the vaccine, or because they might need to take time off to recover. And there are some people who don't want to get it at all. And you know, maybe they just need to know more information about the risks of COVID or the benefits of the vaccine.
Come on, Emily. I think you're giving them way too much credit. There are people who, no matter what fact you lay in front of them, no matter how much common sense you make, no matter what you say, never going to do it. Never.
Sure. So I will get there. But I think, you know, before we deal with those types of folks, I think we still have a ways to go, and employers need to step it up to make sure that people who are hesitant, you know, are truly hesitant and whose minds can be changed, have better access, including things like paid leave for both the vaccination recovery, and have know where to get the vaccine. If you're someone who speaks Spanish or, you know, doesn't have internet access at home, or works hours that, you know, that mean that you aren't, you know, able to go get the vaccine during business hours, it can be hard to get the vaccine. So there's a lot that employers can do to increase access.
Right.
That said, you know, I think there are some categories of employers that need to seriously consider mandating the vaccine for both worker safety and public safety. So, for example, I think healthcare facilities is an obvious one. We have had, you know, hundreds of thousands of people die in nursing homes during the pandemic. But maybe also, you know, high density workplaces like meatpacking plants, where people are literally working elbow to elbow and can't safely social distance.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things that kept coming up is, you know, because, you know, what do you do with them then if they just absolutely refuse? Do you fire them? And as a union guy, I'm like, no, I don't think you should be able to fire them. But do you make them wear masks and all of that stuff? You know, I'm curious, you as the health policy expert, what do you do with those folks who, no matter what you're going to say or do, you know, what's the path?
So, I think vaccine requirements are something that firms will need to seriously consider. You know, that said, I think we shouldn't just assume that these people are never going to get vaccinated. Both unions and employers and local and state government need to be working very hard to make sure that people have good information, because when people don't understand, you know, there's a lot of disinformation out there, right? So we need to make sure that people have good resources, can get their questions answered by people they trust, which includes, you know, peers in their community. It could be religious leaders. It could be physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals. We need to make sure that people have all the information and access that they need.
I look at a state like Ohio, who they're having a lottery. There are going to be five people over the next several weeks who are going to be lucky millionaires for simply going and doing what, for I think most people, is just common sense. I look at West Virginia; they're handing out, I guess, what is it, $100 savings bonds. I've heard of places, you know, giving out whiskey and all kinds of incentives. Are you in favor of the incentives?
I love the creativity. I think it's fantastic. I think, you know, New Orleans is giving away a pound of crawdads. Maine's giving away hunting and fishing licenses. If that's what it takes, so be it. I think any way we can get people to get vaccinated is great.
Now, obviously, you're the health policy expert here. And you know, to talk about the facts, the vaccine is very safe. I mean, in fact, you know, they stopped using the J&J shot because, you know, what was it at the time? 20 women developed some kind of blood clot that they had to figure out. So they stopped it for everybody. So it was so safe that you couldn't even get it because out of, what was it, 7-8 million, 20 people had this reaction.
That's right. The vaccines have, you know, been through rigorous trials in order to even get the authorization from the FDA. You know, these are placebo-controlled trials where half the people are given the vaccine and half aren't. Not only are the vaccines extremely safe, but they also dramatically lower the risk of getting COVID-19. Far above the, you know, the minimum threshold that the FDA set out at the beginning of the pandemic.
Now, you have the folks over there on Fox News, a couple of them anyway, saying, "Well, we don't know, Emily. We don't know what the long term side effects are, and we don't know. But as of this moment, you know, we've had a year of people getting this vaccine almost. You know, anything?"
Yeah, we still know they're safe. So you got to remember that even though the vaccines were approved or they're authorized for the general population only late in 2020, the trials for the vaccine began over a year ago, which means that there are some people out there who've had the, you know, Moderna or J&J or Pfizer shot for a year or more. And, you know, we know that they're very safe and they're very effective. We also know that there are long-term, side effects of having COVID-19, aside from the acute respiratory distress that a lot of people were in with, you know, being in the hospital on a ventilator. We also are seeing people who months or a year later are still suffering from fatigue or circulatory problems or other types of health issues because they had COVID.
So in your article, and I hope folks will take a look at it, employers can accelerate COVID-19 vaccination efforts over at the AmericanProgress.org website. And we'll get links out on how folks can take a look at that. You go through 10 ways that employers can support COVID-19 vaccination. You say improving access. Obviously, we want, I was saying, look, we've got blood mobiles that'll come to your workplace and siphon blood out of you while, you know, they can now do the other thing, I think. That's, we can send ice cream trucks around and do it if we had to.
Right. And I think these are things that, you know, we framed the paper around what employers could do, but it could be any private sector organization or public institution or even unions, right? I talked to some union leaders who said that they were helping arrange for clinics because employees tend to trust the union. Unions could play, you know, help make sure that information is available in break rooms. They could arrange for, you know, Q&A sessions with members. And so I think there are things that all of us can do to step up and ensure that everybody has access to the vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to easy access, as you guys talk about, information, obviously. Mm-hmm. And again, in your article, you talk about incentives, the discounts, the lottery winnings. And of course, you know, then you're saying you just got to require and you got to verify it. So are you talking about, you know, everyone's going to have their passports or their cards or their tattoos across the forehead or whatever?
So I think increasingly, as we see people offering, you know, organizations offering incentives, and businesses requiring vaccination, maybe perhaps in lieu of masking and other measures or, just to show up at work, there will be popping up some credentialing systems. We're seeing private sector companies fill the gap. I think notably New York has created its, a state phone app that you can use to show you're vaccinated. I think these are all sort of organically happening and necessary given the incentives and requirements that we have right now. That said, I hope that employers and firms that are creating these apps ensure that people who don't have digital access are able to access apps, that they're accessible for people with disabilities, and also that they safeguard consumer privacy.
Right. Now, as a health expert, you know, what place do we have to get to before this is in the rearview mirror? I know there's talk of 75% before we hit herd immunity. Not too long ago, you had the CDC and some other folks saying, you know, we're just not going to get there. They don't believe that's going to happen, that COVID is going to be with us for a very long time. I'm curious your thoughts and opinions.
So, you know, there are numbers out there for, you know, so-called herd immunity, but I think the real message is that the more, the better. So if we could get to 70 or 80%, that'd be fantastic. That said, there's no reason to give up just because we're still only at 35% vaccinated. If we could get to say 50 or 60%, which is where Israel and the UK are, we would probably see a similar trend in cases and deaths that they have, which is that, deaths are down to near zero and cases drop dramatically as more of the population got vaccinated.
Now, we don't see the stories every day on the news anymore, but we still have like 700 people who die every day and thousands of people are being infected every day, right?
This is not over yet. That's absolutely right. In fact, you know, most of the counties in the United States are still at a high or substantial level of community transmission, according to the CDC definition. So, you know, it's important that we keep, even though some people are vaccinated, we keep doing things like wearing masks indoors where the transmission is high. I think that's important for protecting workers. Yeah. We'll be going to work and, you know, might not have a way of verifying whether people in the store or the restaurant are actually vaccinated or not.
Yeah, my plan is, and I'm curious your thought as an expert. You know, this summer, you know, I'm taking my kids. We're going to go to a couple of concerts. In the fall, I plan on, you know, attending a football game or two. We plan on kind of trying to go back to what life was normally like. But we're still going to, when we go to these places, going to wear the mask because it seems like common sense to me. Do you think it's safe to go into those environments?
So, you know, a lot of this is going to be going forward is going to be individual decisions about tolerance for risk. You know, I think a lot of it's going to depend on what your local area looks like. Are there a lot of cases? Are people vaccinated? I think folks should weigh that in their decisions. And then it's also, you know, a personal preference. So for myself, I've got two young kids for whom the vaccine is not available yet. So, you know, I'm looking forward to going to, say, outdoor baseball games this summer, but won't be taking them indoors to restaurants or museums until, you know, the community transmission is much, much lower. You know, we would want them to wear masks in the instances where we do go indoors.
So let me ask you this, you know, as the mother of small children, if, you know, because Tucker Carlson said that's child abuse and someone should come in and put you in your place and call Child Protective Services on you for having the audacity to put a mask on a child. Any thoughts?
I think that not having kids wear masks when the level of community transmission is high is irresponsible. You know, I love my kids and I want them to be safe and healthy. I think one thing I've learned through the pandemic is kids are just amazingly resilient and adaptable, and they, you know, go grab their masks every time we go out. And, you know, I think it's peace of mind for all of us to know that they can play around close to other kids and go to school, but also be safe.
It's so nice of you. I mean, my first thought was F Tucker Carlson. And if I find him, if he came up and gave me a hard time, I'd smack him, but that's just me. you know, there's just me and my kids. Very, very different way of handling it. But Emily, I appreciate you taking some time for us, sharing some of your expertise and some of your thoughts. Hope folks will take a look at the article, Employers Can Accelerate COVID-19 Vaccination Efforts, over at AmericanProgress.org. We'll get links out on social media on how you can take a look at that. Emily, it was great talking with you. I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Same. Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. No, and look, you know, for me, this is simple. We're almost through it. Little common sense, little sanity. Don't rush into things. But you know, if you're in a crowd, wear the mask. I think the information by the CDC said today, you know, if you're vaccinated, you know, it's okay. Just a little bit of common sense and a little courtesy of others. Just my thoughts. I'd love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.